Chapter 7. At such an assembly, you see here every variety of coiffure that has ever been known. Some young men of genius have ringlets hanging over their shoulders. You may smell the tobacco with which they are scented across the street. Some have straight locks, black, oily, and redundant. Some have toupets in the famous Louis Philippe fashion. Some are cropped close. Some have adopted the present mode which he who would follow must, in order to do so, part his hair in the middle, grease it with grease, and gum it with gum, and iron it flat down over his ears. When arrived at the ears, you take the tongs and make a couple of ranges of curls close round the whole head, such curls as you may see under a gilt three-cornered hat, and in Her Britannic Majesty's coachman's state wig. This is the last fashion. As for the beards, there is no end of them. All my friends the artists have beards who can raise them, and nature, though as he has rather stinted the bodies and limbs of the French nation, has been very liberal to them of hair, as you may see by the following specimen. Fancy these heads and beards under all sorts of caps: Chinese caps, Mandarin caps, Greek skull caps, English jockey caps, Russian or Kazilbash caps, middle age caps such as are called, in heraldry, caps of maintenance, Spanish nets, and striped worsted nightcaps. Fancy all the jackets you have ever seen, and you have before you, as well as pen can describe, the costumes of these indescribable Frenchmen. In this company and costume the French student of art passes his days and acquires knowledge. How he passes his evenings, at what theaters, at what guinguettes, in company with what seducing little milliner, there is no need to say. But I knew one who pawned his coat to go to a carnival ball, and walked abroad very cheerfully in his blouse for 6 weeks, until he could redeem the absent garment. These young men, together with the students of sciences, comport themselves towards the sober citizen pretty much as the German Bursch towards the Philister, or as the military man, during the Empire, did to the Pekin. From the height of their poverty they look down upon him with the greatest imaginable scorn, a scorn, I think, by which the citizen seems dazzled, for his respect for the arts is intense. The case is very different in England, where a grocer's daughter would think she made a misalliance by marrying a painter, and where a literary man, in spite of all we can say against it, ranks below that class of gentry composed of the apothecary, the attorney, the wine merchant, whose positions, in country towns at least, are so equivocal. As, for instance, my friend the Rev. James Asterisk, who has an undeniable pedigree, a paternal estate, and a living to boot, once dined in Warwickshire, in company with several squires and parsons of that enlightened county. Asterisk, as usual, made himself extraordinarily agreeable at dinner, and delighted all present with his learning and wit. "Who is that monstrous pleasant fellow?" said one of the squires. "Don't you know?" replied another. "He's Asterisk, the author of so and so, and a famous contributor to such and such a magazine." "Good heavens!" said the squire, quite horrified. "A literary man! I thought he had been a gentleman." Another instance. M. Gizet, when he was minister here, at the Grand Hotel of the Ministry, and gave entertainments to all the great de par le monde, as Brantham says, and entertained them in a proper ministerial magnificence. The splendid and beautiful Duchess of Dash was at one of his ministerial parties, and went, a fortnight afterwards, as in duty bound, to pay her respects to M. Gizet. But it happened, in this fortnight, that M. Gizet was minister no longer, having given up his portfolio, and his grand hotel, to retire into private life, and to occupy his humble apartments in the house which he possesses, and of which he lets the greater portion. A friend of mine was present at one of the ex-minister's soirees, where the Duchess of Dash made her appearance. He says the Duchess, at her entrance, seemed quite astounded, and examined the premises with a most curious wonder. Two or three shabby little rooms, with ordinary furniture, and a minister en retraite, who lives by letting lodgings. In our country, was ever such a thing heard of? No, thank heaven. And a Brit not to be proud of the difference. But to our muttons. This country is surely the paradise of painters and penny liners. And when one reads of M. Horace Vernon at Rome, exceeding ambassadors at Rome by his magnificence, and leading such a life as Rubens or Titian did of old, when one sees M. Fear's grand villa in the Rue St. George, a dozen years ago he was not even a penny liner. No such luck, when one contemplates, in imagination, M. Rudin, the marine painter, too lame to walk through the picture gallery of the Louvre, accommodated, therefore, with a wheelchair, a privilege of princes only, and accompanied, nay, for what I know, actually trundled down the gallery by majesty itself, who does not long to make one of the great nation, exchange his native tongue for the melodious jabber of France. Or, at least, adopt it for his native country, like Marshal Saxe, Napoleon, and Anacharsis Clootz. Noble people! They made Tom Paine a deputy, and as for Tom Macaulay, they would make a dynasty of him. Well, this being the case, no wonder there are so many painters in France, and here, at least, we are back to them. At the École Royale des Beaux-Arts, you see 200 or 300 specimens of their performances. All the prize men, since 1750 I think, being bound to leave their prize sketcher picture. Can anything good come out of the Royal Academy, is a question which has been considerably mooted in England, in the neighborhood of Suffolk Street especially. The hundreds of French samples are, I think, not very satisfactory. The subjects are almost all what are called classical. Orestes pursued by every variety of Furies, numbers of little wolf-sucking Romuluses, Hectors and Andromaches in a complication of parting embraces, and so forth. For it was the absurd maxim of our forefathers, that because these subjects had been the fashion 20 centuries ago, they must remain, so in saecula saeculorum. Because to these lofty heights giants had scaled, behold, the race of pygmies must get upon stilts and jump at them likewise. And on the canvas, and in the theater, the French frogs, excuse the pleasantry, were instructed to swell out, and roar as much as possible like bulls. What was the consequence, my dear friend? In trying to make themselves into bulls, the frogs make themselves into jackasses, as might be expected. For 110 years the classical humbug oppressed the nation, and you may see, in this gallery of the Beaux-Arts, 70 years specimens of the dullness which it engendered. Now, as nature made every man with a nose and eyes of his own, she gave him a character of his own too, and yet we, O foolish race, must try our very best to ape some one or two of our neighbors, whose ideas fit us no more than their breeches. It is the study of nature, surely, that profits us, and not of these imitations of her. A man, as a man, from a dustman up to Aeschylus, is God's work, and good to read, as all works of nature are. But the silly animal is never content, is ever trying to fit itself into another shape, wants to deny its own identity, and has not the courage to utter its own thoughts. Because Lord Byron was wicked, and quarreled with the world, and found himself growing fat, and quarreled with his victuals, and thus, naturally, grew ill-humored, did not half Europe grow ill-humored too? Did not every poet feel his young affections withered, and despair and darkness cast upon his soul? Because certain mighty men of old could make heroical statues and plays, must we not be told that there is no other beauty but classical beauty? Must not every little whipster of a French poet chalk you out plays, Henriades, and such like, and vow that here was the real thing, the undeniable Caelan? The undeniable fiddlestick. For 100 years, my dear sir, the world was humbugged by the so-called classical artists, as they now are by what is called the Christian art, of which anon, and it is curious to look at the pictorial traditions as here handed down. The consequence of them is that scarce one of the classical pictures exhibited is worth much more than 2 and 6 pence. Borrowed from statuary, in the first place, the color of the painting seems, as much as possible, to who participate in it. They are mostly of a misty, stony green dismal hue, as if they had been painted in a world where no color was. In every picture, there are, of course, white mantles, white urns, white columns, white statues, those oblige accomplishments of the sublime. There are the endless straight noses, long eyes, round chins, short upper lips, just as they are ruled down for you in the drawing books, as if the latter were the revelations of beauty, issued by supreme authority, from which there was no appeal. Why is the classical reign to endure? Why is yonder simpering Venus de Medicis to be our standard of beauty, or the Greek tragedies to bound our notions of the sublime? There was no reason why Agamemnon should set the fashions, and remain Greek text omitted, to eternity. And there is a classical quotation, which you may have occasionally heard, beginning Vixier Fortes, and see, which, as it avers, that there were a great number of stout fellows before Agamemnon, may not unreasonably induce us to conclude that similar heroes were to succeed him. Shakespeare made a better man when his imagination molded the mighty figure of Macbeth. And if he will measure Satan by Prometheus, the blind old Puritan's work by that of the fiery Grecian poet, does not Milton's angel surpass Aeschylus's surpass him by any Arud? In the same school of the Beaux-Arts, where are to be found such a number of pale imitations of the antique, Monsieur Thiers, and he ought to be thanked for it, has caused to be placed a full-sized copy of The Last Judgment of Michelangelo, and a number of casts from statues by the same splendid hand. There is the sublime, if you please, a new sublime and original sublime, quite as sublime as the Greek sublime. See yonder, in the midst of his angels, the judge of the world descending in glory, and near him, beautiful and gentle, and yet indescribably august and pure, the Virgin by his side. There is Eosis, the grandest figure that ever was carved in stone. It has about it something frightfully majestic, if one may so speak. In examining this, and the astonishing picture of the judgment, or even a single figure of it, the spectator's sense amounts almost to pain. I would not like to be left in a room alone with the Osses. How did the artist live amongst them, and create them? How did he suffer the painful labor of invention? One fancies that he would have been scorched up, like Semmel, by sights too tremendous for his vision to bear. One cannot imagine him, with our small physical endowments and weaknesses, a man like ourselves. As for the École Royale des Beaux-Arts, then, and all the good its students have done, as students, it is stark not. When the men did anything, it was after they had left the academy, and began thinking for themselves. There is only one picture among the many hundreds that has, to my idea, much merit, a charming composition of Homer singing, signed Geordi, and the only good that the Academy has done by its pupils was to send them to Rome, where they might learn better things. At home, the intolerable stupid classicalities, taught by men who, belonging to the least erudite country in Europe, were themselves, from their profession, the least learned among their countrymen, only weighed the pupils down, and cramped their hands, their eyes, and their imaginations, drove them away from natural beauty, which, thank God, is fresh and attainable by us all, today, and yesterday, and tomorrow, and sent them rambling after artificial grace, without the proper means of judging or attaining it. A word for the building of the Palace des Beaux-Arts. It is beautiful, and as well finished, and convenient as beautiful. With its light and elegant fabric, its pretty fountain, its archway of the Renaissance, and fragments of sculpture, you can hardly see, on a fine day, a place more riant and pleasing. Passing from thence up the picturesque Rue de Seine, let us walk to the Luxembourg, where bonnes, students, grisettes, and old gentlemen with pigtails, love to wander in the melancholy, quaint old gardens, where the peers have a new and comfortable court of justice, to judge all the emeutes which are to take place, and where, as everybody knows, is the picture gallery of modern French artists, whom government thinks worthy of patronage. a very great proportion of the pictures, as we see by the catalog, are by the students whose works we have just been to visit at the Beaux-Arts, and who, having performed their pilgrimage to Rome, have taken rank among the professors of the art. I don't know a more pleasing exhibition, for there are not a dozen really bad pictures in the collection, some very good, and the rest showing great skill and smartness of execution. In the same way, however, that it has been supposed that no man could be a great poet unless he wrote a very big poem, the tradition is kept up among the painters, and we have here a vast number of large canvases, with figures of the proper heroical length and nakedness. The anti-classicists did not arise in France until about 1827, and, in consequence, up to that period, we have here the old classical faith in full vigor. There is Brutus, having chopped his son's head off, with all the agony of a father, and then, calling for number two. There is Aeneas carrying off old Anchises. There are Paris and Venus, as naked as two attendants, and many more such choice subjects from Lempriere. But the chief specimens of the sublime are in the way of murders, with which the catalogue swarms. Here are a few extracts from it. 7. Bohm, Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur. He grand dauphus dying. 18. Blondel, Chevalier de la Anne Cienobia found dead. 36. Debe, Chevalier. He death of Lucretia. 38. Dejulin. He death of Hector. 34. Court, Chevalier de la Anne C. He death of Caesar. 39-40-41. Delacroix, Chevalier. Ante and Virgil in the Infernal Lake, the massacre of Scio, and Edia going to murder her children. 43. Delarich, Chevalier. Oas taken from among the dead. 44. T. The death of Queen Elizabeth. 45. E. Edward V. And his brother, preparing for death. 50. H. Hecuba going to be sacrificed. Drolling, Chevalier. 51. Dubois. Aum Clovis found dead. 56. Henry, Chevalier. He massacre of St. Bartholomew. 75. Guerin, Chevalier. Ain, after the death of Abel. 83. Jacquand. Eth of Adelaide de Comminges. 88. T. The death of Eudamidas. 93. T. The death of Imedo. 103. T. The death of Philip of Austria. And so on. You see what woeful subjects they take, and how profusely they are decorated with knighthood. They are like the Black Brunswickers, these painters, and ought to be called Chevaliers de la Mort. I don't know why the merriest people in the world should please themselves with such grim representations and varieties of murder, or why murder itself should be considered so eminently sublime and poetical. It is good at the end of a tragedy, but then, it is good, because it is the end, and because, by the events foregone, the mind is prepared for it. But these men will have nothing but fifth acts, and seem to skip, as unworthy, all the circumstances leading to them. This, however, is part of the scheme the bloated, unnatural, stilted, spouting, sham sublime, that our teachers have believed and tried to pass off as real, and which your humble servant and other anti-humbugists should heartily, according to the strength that is in them, endeavor to pull down. What, for instance, could Monsieur Laffan care about the death of Eudamidas? What was Hecuba to Chevalier Drolling, or Chevalier Drolling to Hecuba? I would lay a wager that neither of them ever. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.